Welcome to This Old Tree, a show that features heritage trees and their human stories. You'll hear interviews with experts, historians, and regular folks to celebrate the myths and uncover the real tales. This Old Tree is sponsored by Schwartz Tree and Landscaping in Cranston, Rhode Island. Professional tree service, landscaping, and plant management. Visit SchwartzTreeCare.com or call 401-941-4440. This show is also sponsored by Foods of New York Tours. Hungry? There's nothing like heading to New York City for some of the best cuisine in the world. Book through their website at foodsofny.com or call 332-236-9635. Now, here is your host, Doug Still.
What does a big old thorny honey locust tree on the campus of the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago have to do with Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, one of the towering figures of 20th century architecture? Would you believe this tree and its species have a place in the history of modernism, specifically its iconic landscapes? Professor Ron Henderson is here to talk about his favorite tree at IIT, about Mies van der Rohe and his colleague Alfred Caldwell, and how the honey locust became the feathery, urban forest powerhouse it is today. I'm your host, Doug Still, and welcome to This Old Tree.
This old tree, standing here for more than four centuries. Wonder what you'd say if you could talk to me about what it's like to be this old tree.
I think I can speak for a lot of people when I say that we sometimes take honey locust trees for granted. If you live in a city in the eastern half of the United States, you've undoubtedly walked underneath the shade of a honey locust tree thousands of times, whether walking along the street, traversing a corporate plaza, or strolling through a local park. They are everywhere with their irregular form and branching patterns, fine foliage, an ability to withstand the toughest of urban conditions such as drought, salt, and neglect. As an urban forester, I know that within the larger goal of selecting trees to plant for diversity, the readily available honey locust tree was the species to choose for the most difficult of situations, saving other more quote-unquote interesting species for places where they're more appreciated. Well, to all Gladitzia triacanthos everywhere, I humbly apologize. It took the research and appreciative eye of my friend Ron Henderson to wake me up out of my maybe slightly condescending attitude to see how beautiful this tree is, and to look at it freshly through the eyes of Mies van der Rohe, his landscape architect Alfred Caldwell, and other mid-20th century modernists. Ron Henderson is professor and director of the Landscape Architecture and Urbanism Program at the Illinois Institute of Technology, or IIT, in Chicago. He's also principal of Lirio Landscape Architecture based in Newport, Rhode Island. He has a broad range of research and interests, including landscape-based urbanism, gardens and arboricultural practices in China and Japan, and his own gorgeous botanical drawing, which has been exhibited at the United States National Arboretum in Washington, D.C. He is the author of The Gardens of Suzhou and numerous articles on landscape architecture and urbanism. His current research includes the Driverless City Project, which focuses on the urban design implications of driverless and autonomous vehicles. He's also my longtime friend. Ron, welcome to the show.
Doug, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
The center of attention today is a 70-year-old honey locust tree that stands outside your design studio on campus at IIT. It's a tree with a distinct place in the history of landscape architecture and modernist design, which you're going to tell us about. But before we get into all that, could you just describe the tree for our listeners in your own words?
Something that most people would notice first about the tree is that it's thorny. It's a Gladitzia triacanthos, the honey locust. It's situated on the south side of IIT's Crown Hall, fairly close to the building, maybe only 10 or 12 feet off of the building. It's probably 24 to 26 inches in diameter. Honey locusts are what we refer to as an open habit or a picturesque habit tree, which means that their trunks are not necessarily straight and their canopies are not symmetrical. So they kind of range in their branching patterns. They're also pinnate leaf trees, which means that their leaves are made up of many small leaflets.
Right. It's actually a double compound.
Yeah. Some leaves are pinnate. Some are double pinnate. And sometimes they're pinnate and double pinnate even on the same leaf.
I say pinnate. Have I been saying it wrong this whole time?
Oh, I don't know.
But yeah, this is very feathery leaf.
It is. So they're fern-like. And what that does is it means that the sunlight penetrates the tree canopy. It's not a very dense leaf pattern. So light penetrates the tree canopy and reaches the ground, which means it's also a tree where grass and herbaceous layers of plants grow quite well under honey locusts.
I think what distinguishes it for me is that irregular form you were talking about. You know, I can tell that it's a honey locust tree from 200 feet away or more, the bending branches and the fine texture to the leaves.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the reasons why this was a tree that was used on the IIT campus. The IIT campus is a, you know, modernist campus, the master plan by Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, the German architect who came to Chicago in the 1930s. And this picturesque habit and open canopy contrasts very distinctly against the kind of right angle cubic massing of the buildings designed by Mies van der Rohe. So there's a really rich relationship and contrast between the buildings and the trees.
Yeah, I love your appreciation for this tree. I have to say, honey locusts are sort of ubiquitous. You know, it's probably the most common street tree in the eastern United States, at least in the Northeast. As a long time, maybe slightly jaded urban forester, I'd probably walk right by the tree without thinking about it too much. But you wrote an article a few years ago about honey locust trees called The Modernist Tree, and it was in Dwell magazine. And part of what makes this tree so special is what it's standing next to. And you had just started describing that.
Yeah. So in Chicago, it is about one third of the species composition of the urban forest. So it has been planted quite a bit over the last 50 years or so because it's so successful, but also because, you know, as we mentioned, the canopy is fairly open, which means light penetrates to the ground. The leaflets are also very small, so that when they fall to the ground, they kind of just disperse in the wind. So those qualities have made it quite a valuable and desirable tree in cities. It's also very rugged.
Yeah, it's probably one of the toughest trees that we plant.
Right.
In terms of soil compaction, salt, its ability to withstand abuse and neglect. It's one of those trees we choose when we're like, okay, we need the toughest tree that we can, this particular spot. You know, that's a place for the honey locust.
It is. And for, you know, in its relationship to buildings, because the canopy is open and rather diaphanous, and the quality of light is so bright beneath it, it's also a tree that's become quite desirable by architects because it's a tree that doesn't hide buildings. It casts a very soft shadow against the wall of the building, but it doesn't hide the architecture, which has made it a very desirable tree by some of the best architects and from some of the best landscape architects of the modernist period in America.
Can you tell us about this building that this tree is standing next to, that where your design studio is, and tell our listeners who might not know who Mies van der Rohe is?
So the building is Crown Hall. It is the home of the School of Architecture at Illinois Institute of Technology. It's listed on the National Register of Historic Places and is recognized for a couple of innovations. First of all, the design studio, which is the place where architecture and landscape architecture students have their desks that they work on their design projects. It's one big room. So it's a universal space, which means everybody can see what everyone else is doing. So it's a little bit of a teaching and learning in a public square kind of space. So several hundred students are in the same large space together.
Right.
The building is a steel structure with glass walls. The steel structure at Crown Hall, part of the innovation is that the girders are on the roof and you don't see them inside the building. So the interior of the building is a very taut, clear rectangle with four corners and smooth floor and a smooth ceiling. And from the outside, it's a very open steel and glass structure. So you can also sense the life and the vitality of the teaching and learning that's happening inside of it. Conversely, when you're inside of it, you're very aware of the trees that Alfred Caldwell, the landscape architect, worked with Meese and was also faculty at IIT, designed and planted around the building.
I was reading a little bit about it. This building as a whole is considered one of Meese's masterpieces.
It is. It is. You know, some of his other well-known buildings includes the Seagram's building on Park Avenue in New York, the Edith Farnsworth house, which was also a steel and glass house, one of the first glass houses just outside of Chicago. But his master plan for IIT, as well as about 13 buildings that he did on our campus, is the highest concentration of his work. Most of us would consider Crown Hall the epitome of his work on our campus.
Just backtracking a bit. So he is considered, you know, one of the greatest modernist architects, right, of the 20th century, with Le Corbusier, Walter Gropius, Frank Lloyd Wright. And he was German. He was previously the director of the Bauhaus in Germany.
That's all correct.
And yes. I was brushing up on my art history. And until he was the last director of the Bauhaus in 1933. Apparently the Gestapo raided their school and dispersed it. It was considered very un-German. Sort of the international style of modernism. They didn't want to have that. That ended the Bauhaus. And he ended up emigrating and then coming to the U.S.
Yeah, that's correct. He and Gropius and several others were able to be invited to teach and contribute to universities in the U.S. So Gropius went to Harvard. Mies van der Rohe came to IIT. Along with him, he brought Ludwig Hilbersheimer, the planner, and others, in a very complex geopolitical time, for sure.
Right. And then, and part of his responsibilities was he commissioned to redesign the campus, as you say.
That's right. That's right. His master plan for the campus was really one of the first importations of Bauhaus planning and compositional principles in urban planning in America. So the composition of buildings at IIT is not what one might expect at a university. We don't have quads, for instance. The buildings kind of slip past one another, and our landscapes are called fields and meadows. So we don't have quadrangles or yard like Harvard, which is a more domestic term. Our terms are more ecological in a way, you know, fields and meadows, because the landscape flows through and among the buildings. It's not defined like a courtyard would be. So the campus is a much more porous spatial order. You know, and the IIT campus, again, to distinguish it maybe from other campuses, because of this modernist spatial planning, it's an open campus. You know, we don't, because we don't have quadrangles. It means we don't have gates and we don't have thresholds through the buildings where you walk through a doorway into the courtyard. The perimeter of our campus is open. So it's open to the neighborhood. It's open to the community. So it's spatially integrated, not a place apart. Although the way the buildings are built distinguishes it from the adjacent neighborhoods. That also means that the landscape can flow through the campus. So with Alfred Caldwell's work with Mies van der Rohe, building what's known as a campus in a park, the buildings float in this lightly wooded landscape that has a series of clearings or openings in the canopy, which are places where the fields are. And so there's a continuity of the landscape that washes across the campus. It's again a little bit distinct from having a series of enclosed spaces and quadrangles.
Right. And a series of separate gardens.
And so one of the things that helps the landscape read almost like a native savanna, which would be the native ecosystem here in Chicago at IIT, is the use of the honey locust as one of the trees. Because of its irregular habit and open canopy, it's a very naturalizing kind of tree, right? As opposed to a linden or a sugar maple or a tree that has a more tight habit and formal character. This ranginess and openness of the honey locust allows it to kind of dance through the campus.
Right. And so it's sort of like a field tree.
It is a field tree,
isn't
yes.
it? In the Midwest, I think its range, it's mainly like from Minnesota down into Texas, in the central part of the country. And I mean, some people probably consider it a weed, but it grows along the edges of forests. And you had a quote in your article. You write, in his 1939 book, Siftings, prairie school landscape architect Jens Jensen wrote, "There is a certain refinement about this tree in its golden yellow autumn color. It gives a soft light to the landscape." Jensen further described the honey locust's common situation along the edges of forests. Down in central Illinois, the honey locust is at home, and in some sections is known as the farmer wife's tree. This name has been given to it because of the fact that it was the farmer's wife who went into the wooded areas along the prairie rivers for locust saplings. It was beside such a country fence row that Alfred Caldwell, who had worked with Jensen, planted some of his first honey locusts at his Wisconsin farm in the early 1940s. We will take a short break and be back with This Old Tree. Hi, I'm Doug Still, and we're back with This Old Tree. First of all, why were the farmers' wives going in the woods for honey locust saplings?
I don't know.
I didn't get that part of it. But that's what he said. But maybe we could talk about who Alfred Caldwell was and how he came to work with Mies van der Rohe.
Alfred Caldwell was a landscape architect, you know, active in Chicago through most of the 1900s. Pretty much his life spanned the century. He grew up in Chicago and began working with Jens Jensen, and was in fact working on the site with Jensen on the Ford Estate north of Detroit, which was one of the first times that the honey locust tree was, as you said, kind of pulled out of the field and brought into the garden. Jensen, who was a proponent of native plant species and an ecologist, among other things, was active in helping to save the Indiana dunes, was using plants that maybe the more academically trained landscape architects on the East Coast were not looking at. So he was perfectly happy using this kind of field tree in a garden.
So Jens Jensen and Alfred Caldwell were really the first champions of the honey locust tree.
Yes. And I think Jensen built an appreciation for it, but there was really no Jensen landscape where the honey locust became iconic. It was Caldwell, and in a different way, the landscape architect Dan Kiley, who elevated the honey locust into becoming an iconic modernist tree. For Caldwell, who designed really some of the most remarkable landscapes in America, all of which are in Chicago, with the exception of a park in Dubuque, Iowa, the Alfred Caldwell Lily Pool in Lincoln Park, Promontory Point Park near the University of Chicago and Hyde Park, as well as a series of projects and ongoing work at IIT. When Mies was relieved of his responsibilities at IIT as director of the architecture program, Caldwell resigned in protest and left the university. He was invited to teach at University of Southern California in Los Angeles, and also did some really remarkable projects there. Caldwell was one of the few people that both Frank Lloyd Wright and Mies van der Rohe liked. Frank Lloyd Wright invited Caldwell to move to Taliesin East in Wisconsin and work with him. Mies first met Caldwell at what's now known as the Alfred Caldwell Lily Pool, a project that he had done when he was with the Chicago Park District. Mies encountered, as the story goes, encountered Caldwell at the park, which has a remarkable wooden gate and a series of stone and wood pavilions that are often characterized as Wrightian. And Mies had a lot of admiration for this work and ended up inviting Caldwell to also teach at IIT. So Caldwell was someone who both Frank Lloyd Wright wanted to work with and Mies van der Rohe wanted to work with. I don't think there are very many people that would be able to span this sense of kind of Bauhaus rigor around the way things are built and the Wrightian spirit of a kind of Jeffersonian agricultural America with a kind of sense of populist democracy that Wright represented. And I think he learned a lot of this from Jensen in terms of how the landscape represented American values in a different way in the Midwest than the more, you know, kind of academic and maybe even still European-looking East Coast.
The modernist style, international styles, began in Europe, you know, after World War I, and had become international. But the honey locust is a species native to the American Midwest, as we said, and it's sort of distinctly American. And I find this sort of blending of backgrounds really interesting. But do you think that Mies's choice of the honey locust and, you know, working with Caldwell was purely aesthetic and practical? Or was there also, you know, an additional meaning there too about sort of adapting to culture beyond regional boundaries, if you know what I mean?
I do. When you look at the multitude of drawings and studies that Mies van der Rohe did as he was designing the IIT campus master plan, you see someone who's drawing the buildings with straight edges, with triangles and T-squares and very precise lines. And then when that's sort of laid out, you see that he picks up a fat, thick pencil and he does these incredibly gestural squiggles across this very precise drawing. And he's drawing the trees.
Right.
Yeah, so the drawings give evidence that Mies was looking at that contrast between the cubic linearity of the buildings and the gestural vitality of trees. Caldwell was able to fulfill Mies's sense of what the landscape would be by recommending the honey locust as the primary tree on campus, because as we come back to this picturesque habit, open habit, and the quality of light that they provide.
A short digression. The more I spoke to Ron, the more I realized that it was landscape architect Alfred Caldwell that helped catapult the honey locust from wild field tree to modernist darling. I had the honor and pleasure to speak with someone who knew him. His name is Richard Polanski, who owns an orchard not far from the Caldwell farm. Here's a snippet from our talk as Richard helps bring Alfred Caldwell alive for us. So, Richard, tell me a little bit about how you came to know Alfred Caldwell.
Well, it was in 1982. My wife and I had decided to strike away from our career kind of jobs after a few years out, several years out of college, and we decided to buy an apple orchard. And we had rented an orchard and got our feet wet that way, and not from rural backgrounds or anything, either one of us. It was a big decision to make. And it was that same month in 1982 that Caldwell called me because, and that's through a reference to my mother-in-law, who lived across the street from the Caldwell farm in Bristol, Wisconsin.
Gotcha. And
he called me one night and asked me if I could come over to take down a little shed that he had built on his 40 acres. It was the first little shed, an 8x12 wooden shed that he built right after World War II when he bought that 40 acres. And I said, well, I can do that. I worked in the area. So 17-mile drive over there, met him. And he told me he didn't have to be there when I tore this down, but he gave me all these rules about not driving on the lawn and whatnot, of course, which I broke all of those rules. Tore it down, got rid of the concrete underneath it. And a few days later, he called me and said, when are you coming back? He was so happy. He was so happy that I did it. And how much he wanted to know how much to pay. And I said, I put the building back up. It's already in use. And he couldn't believe it. And then he would call at 7:30 almost every night and tell, say, when can you come over?
He clearly liked you.
Right. We hit it off pretty well right off the bat. He had a 4-acre apple orchard up in the corner of the 40 acres. And that's something he planted the year after he bought that property, right after World War II, which was what the first time he ever had any money, he said. His family was very poor. Kind of wanted to do, I think, what Frank Lloyd Wright did, who he had met 10, 12 years earlier than that. And they talked about being architects in the United States at that time. It was tough to do. And so, Wright went out on his own and started that the farm. And Alfred kind of fell in that same idea of a place to be your own person and to be able to develop and be totally free from constraints, I think.
How would you describe his personality? What was he like?
Well, he could be the sweetest man, quite unbelievable in certain ways. Like most people are probably familiar with Jehovah's Witness, where a religious group comes and knocks on the door and they want to pass out some of their information. And virtually every year, some summer day, they would show up way back into the property and knock on the door. And he would ask me to get him a glass of water. And we would sit and talk for a few minutes. And he would just be so sweet about that. But he could also be just a bear, the wrong person at the wrong time. He would, physically, just about physically remove you, get out of here. And it could be terrible. One of his colleagues at the campus, Louis Johnson, Louis could come and they would go off and talk about bees or have these conversations about the school. And then 2 hours later, they could be in a huge argument and Louis would have to leave.
Not
in a huff. So it was the full range.
Right. He knew how to get things done.
He did. And at the same time, you didn't realize how hard you were working. He was just so good at that. And I remember reading from his memorial service, people who had written about their experience as students of his, that so many people remark that they had no idea they were capable of so much, that he brought it, you know, he got it out of them in one way or another.
That's amazing. So, what's one of your favorite stories about him?
Oh, gee, I've thought about all of these things so many times, and it's hard to place one because there's so many. But I think in relation to trees, which were such a big part of his life, and I don't mean tree, but like a particular tree, but trees and forests, and late after many years of working there, I really didn't spend much time in the woods because we were doing building projects, and we had built a council ring out in the woods, and then he wanted me to make a path through the woods down around a marsh and then to meet up in a different location, and the instructions were this is just great. The instructions were I want a path that a blind man walking in the dark will not stumble.
Okay. And a good path.
Right. And of course, but then without disturbing the roots that are growing above the ground. So it was quite a thing. So I started in on it, laid out a few different areas where we could where I could do that, and I showed him. And then one day I was out walking around in a part of the woods that hadn't seen before, and it was not filled with the invasive species, buckthorn, Rhamnus cathartica, is it? So that part of the forest was not invaded. And I went, geez, that's really interesting. So I was walking around in that part, and I found a card table chair, you know, just a metal folding chair leaning up against a tree. I went, well, I'll take that up to the house. And so later when I was done, I took it up there and I said, I found this in the woods. Put that back. So that is really a great story. It's him, you know, that was his chair out in his woods that he used.
And what's a council ring?
A council ring he got it from Jens Jensen, the landscape architect whom he worked for early on. And kind of Alfred said he kind of saved him from, made him a man to think big thoughts, not just small thoughts. Hmm. But so Jensen built these, a council ring. They can be, the one we built is only about 15, 17 feet in diameter. And it's a field stone, or not field stone, I'm sorry. This one is limestone, flat rocks, stones that we were able to get from a quarry up in central Wisconsin, where we did go and he selected special pieces of those stones for certain spots. So it's a circle and it's about 17 inches high, you know, a decent sitting height. And there could be a fire pit in the middle like this one, but it's for sitting and talking and meeting and being with people in a ring.
Ron told me that he wrote poetry and short stories. What's your experience with those?
Some things I can think of. The one that he had me have engraved on a mantle of the beautiful, fabulous fireplace in his studio, which is a wooden structure. He had me find someone to engrave, you know, to cut in like to cut into the stone. Mm-hmm. And the poem is Wisconsin wood smoke, bright days wheel to slush in golden rut. And that's a poem that he wrote thinking about when he worked for Jens Jensen, and he would drive into Wisconsin looking for plant material, trees, shrubs, flowers, different things. And he would drive his old car. He said that it had, you know, cardboard for the floor and just holes in it. And he would be driving through the countryside, and often in the winter, driving along, and you see that in the winter, the, you know, every house has a chimney with smoke coming out of it. And then as the sun comes up on these snowy, icy roads, they turn to slush and then they get rutted. And so there's the golden rut. And so that was his comment on those days in working for Jensen.
I later asked Richard about Mies van der Rohe and Richard Caldwell.
Do you remember the story of how they met?
That was when Mies and I think it was Hilversheimer. Or no, Hilversheimer came later. It was in 1938, and Mies was in Chicago basically looking for a job. And Alfred was working on the lily pond on Fullerton at Lincoln Park, and Mies was there and happened to be there, and they started talking, and Mies got very interested in this man, Alfred Caldwell. Mm-hmm. And then that's really when it all started. And it wasn't, I don't know how long after that, but Mies started calling Alfred because Mies wanted Alfred to teach. And Alfred kept hanging the phone up on him because of Mies's German accent. He thought this guy was saying, "This is me. This is me." He called several times. He finally realized it's Mies van der Rohe who's calling him.
Right.
So then they did meet and went through, you know, they had to figure out how to get Alfred into the school without having any credentials other than what he could do.
We will take a short break and be back with This Old Tree. Hi, I'm Doug Still, and we're back with This Old Tree.
Jens Jensen had Alfred Caldwell to assist him, and as did Mies van der Rohe. And Alfred Caldwell had you to assist him. Do you have a Richard Polanski in your life that you're passing some of this information or knowledge down to?
Boy, that's quite a question. Well, my orchard is my life, aside from all the things that I've done with Alfred's things. And I really hope that I do have some time now as I'm 72 and I can't keep doing all this orchard work. But for me, there are some young people here at my orchard, Rachel, who started working with me over at Caldwell's and now lives in the old farmhouse here and is married. And there are some young people in my life that I'm hoping that they will continue our apple orchard here, which is an important thing to me.
I'm going to let you go, but I really enjoyed talking with you today and learning about Alfred Caldwell and other people in his life and your work. Some great stories, and I really enjoyed it. So thank you.
Well, thank you.
And back to Ron.
You know, I'm working on a new landscape architecture master plan for the campus with the Chicago landscape architect, Chandra Goldsmith Gray. And we're looking to diversify the species because there are too many honey locusts in the overall proportion, and looking at things like Kentucky coffee trees and yellow woods, as well as the nut trees, the hickories and walnuts.
Trees with compound leaves.
Exactly.
Open forms.
Compound leaves, open form. Almost all of them have yellow fall foliage.
Right. Very nice. You and your family are from Indiana, which is smack in the middle of the honey locust natural range. Would you say that you have a homegrown appreciation for this tree. And what is it about the honey locust that speaks to you?
I do not have a homegrown appreciation for the honey locust tree. I have a homegrown appreciation of chinkapin oaks and persimmons. I think this is a learned appreciation, almost an academic appreciation that grew out of being at IIT, but I began to understand how its qualities are so positive in this particular kind of setting. You know, before I had a deep understanding of IIT, a place that I came to about a decade ago, my appreciation for the honey locust was more focused on another project in Southern Indiana, in Columbus, Indiana, which is another center of modernism in America, a small town with a remarkable collection of works by modern architects and landscape architects. There, the landscape architect Dan Kiley, working in collaboration with the architect Eero Saarinen, and with Alexander Girard, the interior designer and graphic designer, worked on a project for the Miller family, who were the owners of Cummins Engines. And one of the great modernist gardens in America is the Miller Garden that grew out of that project. Kylie had a more European sense of tree planting, whereas Caldwell planted drifts of trees. Kylie planted grids and allées and lines, a very geometrically ordered spatial sequence of distinct rooms and spaces using any number of species. But iconically at the Miller Garden is an allée of honey locusts that almost are like a landscape loggia between the living room of the house, looking out over the great lawn that rolls down to the river.
Yeah, very beautiful.
It is. And those are much different trees. Kylie selected trees that were a little more consistent. So the trunks were the same diameter. They're a little bit more straight trunked, whereas Caldwell might look to find the most gnarly asymmetrical tree. Kylie would try and find matched trees.
So most likely Caldwell selected the tree outside Crown Hall.
Oh, for almost certainly. He selected all of the trees for his projects.
And is that in a drift or is that on its own?
It's part of a little grove.
You said it's covered in thorns and I assume seed pods.
Yes.
Which is interesting. But around this time, a new variety of honey locust was developed and patented, which you described in your article at Siebenthaler Nursery in Ohio. How did that play into how the honey locust was planted and approached in the following decades?
You know, so the native honey locust has very sharp, pronounced thorns that grow out of the trunk. Native Americans use those thorns to, you know, as needles and for sewing leather. So they're very sharp. And yes, they have very large seed pods. They're in the Poa family. So they're like big pea pods with a very leathery casing. And, you know, maybe they average somewhere around 8 to 12 inches long. Those two characteristics, thorns, which could hurt people, and the pods, which become litter in a urban setting and there are a lot of them. Those are less desirable, although I love them. And on an aside, the honey locust range, as you noted, was in the Midwest. Over the last several millennia, the range of the honey locust has retreated because those seed pods had a symbiotic relationship as food for megafauna. So giant sloths and mastodons were able to make able to eat the leathery seed pods. They would be scarified as they were digested. And so that relationship between megafauna and the honey locust is such that if you go to the Field Museum here in Chicago and you see the dioramas with these megafauna painted on the walls behind them are honey locusts. And so the pods, they're hard for other smaller fauna to digest. So their range had been reduced. But it also meant that, you know, in the 20th century, that was not a very desirable trait. So the Siebenthaler nursery, my understanding is they discovered a tree not far from their nursery, a honey locust tree that didn't have seed pods and was thornless. So they began to propagate it. And so that variety, the moraine honey locust, grew out of their nursery and was one of the first, in fact, I believe it was the first shade tree patented in America after the Plant Patent Act from the 1930s. So Caldwell largely used the thorny pod tree.
Right. He would have had that available to him.
Yes.
These new, the new cultivar.
Yes.
But he chose not to use
it. Kiley, on the other hand, selected Gleditsia triacanthos inermis, as it's known, which is the thornless, seedless variety for the Miller Garden in Columbus, Indiana.
Now, I called Siebenthaler Nursery at your urging prior to this interview and spoke with Jeff Siebenthaler. And he said that the original moraine tree does no longer exist. The particular field where it was has been plowed under and is now a housing development or something.
Of course.
He described it as, so there's Gleditsia triacanthos inermis, which is the variety, and then moraine is a cultivar of that. But the moraine, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know however you look at it, is not seen in the nursery trade much anymore. There are many different other cultivars that are used prominently.
Yeah, there are Skyline and many.
Shade Master.
That's right.
Other ones. So I have one last question for you. When you walk by this tree nearly every day, or at least very often, what passes through your mind when you see it?
Giant sloths.
Very interesting. I had no idea.
So I teach plants and design in our landscape architecture and urbanism program. And for that class, the first day of the class, I do a walk around the campus. And I start with that tree. It's the first tree that I bring the students to. We walk out of Crown Hall, walk down the travertine steps, walk to the east 30 feet or 40 feet. And we start talking about the world that that tree embodies. It's Bauhaus, it's modernism, it's giant sloths, it's the quality of the light, it's the shape of the trunk and the branching. It's the shadows that it casts on the glass walls of Crown Hall. It's the texture of the light that penetrates into their studios where they're working. So much gets embodied in that one tree. So my campus walk is about an hour and 45 minutes, but I spend 30 minutes or more just at that one tree.
We were talking about giving it a name, and I was thinking, why not the Mies van der Rohe honey locust? But with your talk about Alfred Caldwell and his influence, I don't know, we'll have to come up with something different.
We do refer to the space to the south of Crown Hall as the Alfred Caldwell Grove or as the Caldwell Grove. So it's interesting that we don't have a particular name for this one tree. So we tend to just refer to that collection as the Caldwell Grove.
The Caldwell Grove. Okay. Thanks for joining me today. Really enjoyed our conversation.
Same here as always, Doug. Let's plant some more trees.
Will do. Take care.
Well, I ended up calling it the Mies van der Rohe honey locust in the Alfred Caldwell Grove. Ron, I hope that's okay. Maybe it'll catch on. And thanks again for elevating the honey locust tree in my eyes and the view of history. I'm Doug Still, and thank you, tree lovers, for joining me on This Old Tree. If you like the show, one way to show your support is to hit the subscribe button on your podcast app, and that way we're easy to find the next time you want to listen. You can get links and information about our guests in the show notes, and see photos and other related tree stuff if you follow This Old Tree on Instagram or Facebook, and now Mastodon. Here's arborist and songwriter Dee Lee to take us out.
This old tree, standing here for more than four centuries. Wonder what you'd say if you could talk to me about what it's like to be this old tree. Shadow and shade, kids down the block are selling lemonade. Send them down a cool breeze, a sweet cascade, tailor-made by this old tree. '1600, you were just a seed, reaching for the sky high, waiting for a chance to take your place in the warm sunshine. Here I go, high above the place where the people grow. Leave my troubles on the ground far below, so I can get to know this old tree. Summer sparkle in your leaves. Autumn winds will bring a release. Winter calls for you to sleep. Spring returns again in green. Above the town, ships on the water spy your royal crown. Sentinel of green, 2 points off starboard bow. Homeward bound to this old tree. In 1800 you felt the thunder roll, and lightning split the sky high. Though the fire raged in the little town below, you managed to survive. With the scar upon your side, this old tree, reach out and touch a living history. Beneath my hands, an ancient mystery. How small I am by this old tree. How small I am by this old tree.
Thank you for listening to This Old Tree. This Old Tree is sponsored by Schwartz Tree and Landscaping in Cranston, Rhode Island. Professional tree service, landscaping, and plant management. Visit SchwartzTreeCare.com or call 401-941-4440. This show is also sponsored locally by Foods of New York Tours. Hungry? There's nothing like heading to New York City for some of the best cuisine in the world. Book through their website at foodsofny.com or call 332-236-9635.